Hello, I'm Luis Hernandez, and welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Now, before we get into the program, there is a breaking news story that I need to tell you about. There's a potentially dangerous situation unfolding in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and it's a manhunt that's in progress for an inmate facing death. He escaped from the Broward County Courthouse this morning. Now, the courthouse has been evacuated, but they're still searching for the suspect. He's been identified as 21-year-old Deontay Resellis. He was on death row for murdering a Davy woman in her home 2 years ago in a botched robbery attempt. Jill Halliburton Sue was the wife of a University of Florida professor and a relative of the Halliburton oil family. Now, we'll keep you informed on this situation as more information comes to us. But again, a manhunt is in progress in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Broward County sheriffs do have a picture of the suspect up online. We'll post that for you as well. Now back to the program. Well, the U.S. is the 10th largest sugar producer in the world. Within the U.S., really four states produce sugarcane, and they include Hawaii, Texas, Louisiana, and the biggest producer, of course, us, Florida. It's an industry that operates in the central part of the state, just south of Lake Okeechobee, and there are small towns dotting the lake that depend on U.S. sugar and Florida crystals for their livelihood. Some of those include Pahokee, Belglade, and the town of Clewiston. Why are we talking about the sugar industry today? Well, there are people who say that the sugar industry is the reason we have a polluted Lake Okeechobee, and that pollution has siphoned off through the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee rivers to the coast, creating this massive algae bloom that we've been talking about so much. Well, Brent Meinhold is one of the managers of Ohana Surf Shop in Stuart, and he started a petition to press the public supermarket company to drop products from U.S. sugar and Florida crystals. And they've garnered more than 15,000 signatures. And here he is discussing how that algae bloom is impacting life along the coasts.
Even if they're going down to visit, they can't. They're not going out on their boats. They're not going out to see the manatees. They're not going out to do the things that you normally do, especially in these areas on the water.
All right, I'm sorry. That is not Meinhold, as I said. But again, talking about this algae bloom and how it's impacting people on the coast. Now, a new report shows that the sugar industry has given tens of millions of dollars to legislators in Tallahassee over the years. And some environmentalists claim this is the reason that lawmakers have ignored things like the voter-approved Amendment 1 that would use hundreds of billions of dollars a year to buy land for Everglades restoration. Now, the report also shows that the sugar industry is not the only polluter. So today, we want to look at where all this money is going and to which lawmakers? Is the industry just trying to protect itself? Is it buying the ability to pollute? And then, of course, we're going to hear from someone in the center of sugar country. We're going to talk to the mayor of Clewiston. But first, joining me now is Mary Ellen Kloss from the Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald, Tallahassee Bureau. Mary Ellen, welcome to the program.
Hello, good to be here.
All right, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. By the way, I just want to mention, too, that for our listeners, you can join our segment online by tweeting us at WLRN. Find our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Share your comments or questions. Mary Ellen, let's talk about this report. What was the most surprising thing about the findings, besides the fact that you had all this money going from the sugar industry to these campaigns?
Well, I have to say, when I look back over the last two decades, and I have covered Florida politics and government from Tallahassee for two decades, and I guess I really was pretty stunned at the total amount of money that the sugar industry has amassed and given to the political process. The number only looked at state campaigns and the amount of money recorded in the Division of Elections in Florida. Of course, there's money given by the industry to congressional campaigns as well. And I didn't even add that up. But when you talk about $57.8 million over 20 years, that's a lot of cash. And it was obviously used in a way that, like anybody who works in the system, they have absolutely every right to contribute as much money as they can to the political process.
There's no question. But that kind of money, yeah, though, no question, gives anyone a lot of political juice. And you point out state lawmakers like Governor Rick Scott, well, let's say Governor Rick Scott, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, other lawmakers, state lawmakers, who've spent time with U.S. Sugar, specifically at their property, King Ranch in Texas. And I'm just curious, what goes on in those gatherings? And is that the only time they're getting together?
Well, because it is, so King Ranch is a very popular, really premier hunting ranch in Texas. And U.S. Sugar, several years ago, obtained a giant piece of the property there and established its own little beachhead, in a sense, created a spot in which it invites politicians and important people. And and it's really all about relationships. So you bring, I really don't know how many female legislators, if any, have been invited, but there are a lot of men that are brought to this ranch, and they hang out and they get to, you know,
Are they talking shop? But are they talking politics? Are they talking about how the sugar industry could be helped?
You know, it's my understanding that it doesn't matter because it's all about who you can trust and who you like and who you respect. And if you go out there and just, you know, have a good old time, then there is a possibility when those people show up at your door and ask for a favor, you're more willing to open the door and you're more willing to listen to them. And that's how this works.
Can you give me an example of how all of this money over the years has benefited the sugar industry, maybe loosened up restrictions, something directly that we could say, look, this has benefited you?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to do when we looked at this money is kind of go back and look at all the kind of pivot points, the really big decision points in which the legislature and the governor had a role to play in deciding which direction to go. And we saw things, you know, so then I went and just looked at some of these decisions, and in every single one of them, the legislature and the governor kind of chose the course that provided the easiest landing for the industry. Now, you begin with 1996. The voters in Florida approved an amendment called the Polluter Pays Amendment that was designed to require that the industries that were contributing to Everglades pollution were, quote, who were primarily responsible for the pollution would have to pay for their share of the damage. It was called the Polluter Pays Amendment, and it was not self-executing. So it required the legislature to come in, write a law, and say, this is how this is going to be enacted. Well, if the legislature doesn't write a law, then the constitutional amendment doesn't get enacted. Well, that passed in 96. It was never enacted. In fact, then-Governor Lawton Childs basically went to the court and said, can they do this? Can they not enact it? And the court said, yes, they can do this. They can totally ignore it. So since then, of course, we've had constitutional amendments that are self-implementing and don't need the legislature to weigh in. But it wasn't until 2003 when the legislature finally addressed the Polluter Pays Amendment. And at that time, they said, well, the existing taxes that the sugar industry has already imposed that have been imposed on the industry to clean up the Everglades, and that was something that was put into law. They said it's never going to be more than $25 an acre, and that will qualify for the Polluter Pays Amendment.
So I mean, there are a lot of things that have happened since the mid-90s that environmentalists saw as the opportunity for Everglades restoration and to kind of, not to say stick it to the sugar industry, but to really put some restrictions. And a lot hasn't happened, but I don't want to, you know, there's a lot to cover in that. One of the things though, I do want to ask you is this. All right, so we look at this algae bloom situation, and there are folks on the coast who are saying, look, we know who the polluters are, or they say they know who the polluters are, and it's causing a problem for everybody. You did point out in your report, sugar industry is not the only polluter.
Right.
Who is the polluter? Who do we blame? Can we point the finger at somebody?
Well, there's been a lot of research and science that have gone into what is the contributing causes. The runoff and the pollution in Lake Okeechobee is only one of the problems of in the entire Everglades ecosystem. And right now, because of the algae outbreak, Lake Okeechobee and the releases from Lake Okeechobee is where all the attention has gone. The goal of this work that I did was to really show that this has been a long-term cycle. And the sugar industry, while it has been engaged in helping to find a resolution to this, has also made sure that it hasn't shouldered as much of the burden as maybe could have been put on the okay. industry's pocket. So
I want you to hang on for a moment for me, Mary Ellen. I want to turn things over now for a moment because we do hear from we've heard from politicians on this. We've obviously heard from environmentalists on this. We have reached out to U.S. Sugar, did not hear back. That invitation is always there for them. But I do want to hear from someone who lives at the center of sugar country. And I want to bring in Philip Rowland. He's the mayor of the town of Clewiston. Now, the town of Clewiston, right there at the below Lake Okeechobee, it is actually, if you've ever driven through, there is a sign. The sign into the city says America's Sweetest Town, because that is where U.S. Sugar is headquartered. Mayor Rowland, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know what you hear about? You hear these stories. You hear the stories about the algae blooms. You hear people getting angry. People who live on the coast, they're getting angry, and they want the state to do something about the Everglades restoration. Let's clean up the lake. And now they're angry at the sugar industry. Okay, well, you're at the center of sugar country. What do you think about all that?
Well, I know I'm 75 years old. I was a county commissioner for 20 years in this county, in Hendry County, before I became mayor 4 years ago in Clewiston. And I have never worked for U.S. Sugar. I had convenience stores. But our problem in the lake today goes all the way back 1960, when they straightened the Kissimmee River.
Right. Are you saying that the issues we're facing now with pollution go all the way back that far?
Absolutely. And I had never seen a green algae bloom, and I have lived my life on the lake. I'd never seen a green algae bloom until after I come out of the service. I got out of the service in 74, and I started fishing the lake again, and all of a sudden I started seeing the blooms happening.
So
now at that time, there was still back pumping from agriculture.
And that's when water's being used by agriculture to water the fields and then sent back out into the water sources where it came from.
Yeah, when it rained bad, when the rainy seasons came, they would back pump into the lake. Well, that stopped in about 84, 85, sometime in that period. But the Corps of Engineers dug three major canals, one being a river, the Kissimmee River, then Indian Prairie, and they call it a canal, but it's about 100 feet wide, and one more.
If I could, though, and I apologize, Mayor Rowland, only because of time, I wanted to come back to this moment, though. So, look, I as a disclaimer, I have to say this. I grew up my childhood in Clewiston. And I also do want to mention,
did you really?
I did, and this was in the late 70s when my family came to this country. I also have to mention, too, as a disclaimer, my grandfather for a brief period of time did work for U.S. Sugar. I did not, so I don't have any other connection to the industry. So I understand this, though. This is what I want to get to with you. I understand that town depends a lot on U.S. Sugar. That's a big part of the economy there. A number of years ago, when former Governor Charlie Crist had talked about buying up a lot of sugar land for Everglades restoration, there was a fear in that town the town could disappear. Now,
oh, absolutely.
You hear all this.
But it wouldn't happen.
Okay. Now, you hear all this from environmentalists. You hear all this from people living on both coasts of Florida, and they are pointing the finger at the sugar industry, and they're saying, that's to blame. Our problems on the coast are to blame what's happening there. But what's your take on this?
Well, I've explained that. I've met with the people from the East Coast and the West Coast and talked to them about during the wet season, 8 billion gallons a day comes from the north. 8 billion. That's from the Kissimmee, the Harney Pond, and the Indian Prairie Canal.
Water that's moving south into the Lake Okeechobee, yes.
Yes, sir, from the Kissimmee Valley. And the Kissimmee Valley covers 5,500 square miles. And 5,500 square miles drain in to a 700 square mile lake.
So the lake overflows. The lake will flood at times. This causes problems.
Overflow.
Okay. And so that's why we have to let the water out. And then, of course, that nutrient-laden water heads out to the estuaries where it's usually not going. It didn't go before we built those rivers, and now it's causing the algae bloom. Let me get to this point, and again, I apologize because I have to cut it short a little bit. But, do you think that there's a middle ground where we can protect the lake, clean it up, protect it, not have to go after any industry in particular, but in this case, not harm the sugar industry, which could harm your town, and still, and cities along the coast could also kind of get their way as well. Do you think there's a middle ground, or really is there going to be a winner and loser here?
Well, there doesn't have to be a winner and a loser. There has to be a winner because we've got to clean up the water, but you can't clean the water up. And I've been fighting this for 30 years. You cannot clean the water up without storing water north of the lake.
Do you think the state should buy some land to store water? Should we be buying like Charlie Crist had tried to do?
Well, they've bought thousands upon thousands of acres already, but they need that. This is South Florida Water Management, which is the state. But they need to buy 5,000 acres alone just north of the lake.
So they have to buy land north of the lake as well as south of the lake. Let me finish with you on this. If anything happened to the sugar industry, what would happen to your town?
The whole area around south of the lake would die. There's not any sustaining business besides agriculture.
Mm. Again, I'm talking with Clewiston Mayor Philip Roland Clewis in a town there at the bottom of Lake Okeechobee. It's on the border of Hendry and Palm Beach counties, and it is, of course, the center of where U.S. Sugar is located. I want to come back before I finish up this segment to Mary Ellen Kloss. Mary Ellen, you hear this. I wonder, because you have really two worlds, and this is almost any state you go to. I saw this in Nevada. There's a separation. You have the metropolitan hubs on the coast, and then you have the agricultural center, the agricultural world in the center of the state, and there's going to be a push and pull and a tug. Obviously, we see from the report, U.S. Sugar is putting a lot of money to protect itself. But, I mean, is there, a fight, a division between two sides here, and do you see a winner or loser?
You know, I think there is. And to me, what's really important to keep in mind is that this is the state's natural resource. This is the source of the source of water for all of South Florida. And it needs to be protected. And it needs to be a balancing act. I don't think that any of the environmental concerns are talking about completely eliminating the sugar industry. But I think there is also a tug and pull about how much sacrifice the industry is making and should be making. And they will argue, and they have done a lot of things to improve the water that leaves their their property now is cleaner sometimes than most of the runoff going into the lake from the development areas north of the lake. But the question is the legacy pollution that's in this system and cleaning it up and making sure that we reverse the damage we've done for decades until now.
And real quickly, in a few seconds here, can you do me a favor and tell me, I wonder, there's been a lot of pressure on the governor on this issue, especially on the algae bloom issue and the cleanup of the lake, but do you see any pressure on lawmakers before they go into session in March to deal with this issue? Amendment 1-2 will come up.
Yeah, and there is an intense focus right now on legislators. Senator Joe Negron is going to be Senate president. St. Lucie is in his backyard. And that's where the most of the algae bloom is happening. But the one thing that I think you raise a good point, and that is that the public needs to hold their elected officials accountable and demand answers from them. What is your answer? What are you going to do? And it is not just giving one side the advantage two decades.
And, of course, a topic we will continue to cover from now until March. And, of course, we have a link to your story at our website so people can go and see and learn more about this money and how much money the sugar industry has given to political campaigns over the years. By the way, Mary Ellen, I mispronounced your name. My apologies. Mary Ellen Class for the Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald, Tallahassee Bureau. We also heard from the Clewiston Mayor, Philip Rowland. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. All right, coming up, the Venezuela crisis becomes darker. Questions loom. What is the tipping point to change things in that country? And if you're from Venezuela, have your family there. We want to hear from you to get your perspective. What's going on? That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so if you look up civil wars and government overthrows in just the last few decades, well, the list just goes on and on and on. And I wondered, what is the tipping point that leads a group of people to just finally say enough and they overthrow the government and start over? By the way, did you know that in Iceland they had an overthrow? Yeah, Iceland, that little country that made a lot of noise in Euro 2016 in the soccer tournament, they overthrew their government after a banking fraud scandal. They set up a citizens group to write a new constitution. Iceland. I bring it up because I'm talking about Venezuela. On July 10th, 35,000 Venezuelans crossed the border into a small Colombian town, and they did it because they had to get supplies and food. This is even though President Nicolas Maduro had tried to close the borders. And a recent report from the United Press International shows that there has been a 24% increase in protests in Venezuela. In the first 6 months of this year, over 3,000 protests. People want food. They're looking for basic supplies, even electricity sometimes. So you wonder, what's the tipping point? At some point, do things finally change? So joining me now, I'm here in studio, Tim Padgett, our Latin American reporter. Tim, always a pleasure.
As it is to be with you.
All right. And joining us from the studios at the Miami Herald, Antonio Maria Delgado of El Nuevo Herald. Antonio, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I do want to ask, by the way, anybody from Venezuela, or if you have family there, we'd like to hear from you as your perspective on what's going on. Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN. Tim, President Maduro tried to close the border, but 35,000 people crossed the border. He did nothing about it, decided to let them go. But, I mean, what is this a sign of is losing his grip of power?
I don't know if it's so much of a sign of his losing grip on power as he's afraid of losing his base. And what he's seeing is that it's not just, you know, the right-wing conspiracy that wants to, you know, get across the border and get supplies. He's seeing the people who vote for his socialist party, who are now desperate for food and medicine and those supplies, and they want to get over the border to Colombia to get it. So he's got to let them, or that's when he starts losing political influence.
Is there a concern, though, of giving the military, because he's kind of given the military a little bit more power than usual? Anytime somebody gives the military, you know, a little more power, there's a a concern, right?
Sure, but for the moment, he can be fairly confident. And I don't know if Antonio would agree with this or not at this point, but I think for the moment he can be fairly confident that he's still got most of the military on his side, although there are a lot of rumblings that they would love to get rid of him and put somebody more competent from the Socialist Party into the presidential palace.
Antonio, what's the take on really the feel in Venezuela about President Maduro and whether or not they want to keep him?
Well, talking about the military, I think the high command is decidedly with them. Government have been giving them all sorts of concessions throughout the years, and at this time they're pretty much entrenched. But at junior levels, though, things are quite a bit different. There's a lot of rumblings, like Tim said, at the military installations. They're having also scarcity problems. There are reports that even the military personnel, the soldiers, are not eating every day. They have problems supplying them with food. And one of the reasons why the distribution of food was given just recently to the defense minister to take charge of was just to make sure that the soldiers are fed.
And so, because right now it's not just people from Venezuela going into Colombia, leaving the border to find food and supplies. Mm-hmm. You got smugglers from Colombia coming in, bringing food and supplies, Tim, to, well, basically sell in the black market.
Oh, sure. And as you pointed out, I mean, you've got still Venezuelans smuggling gasoline from Venezuela into Colombia, because even with the subsidies reduced recently, a gallon of gas in Venezuela still costs about 50 cents a gallon. You can sell it over in Colombia for about $2.50 a gallon. So,
you know, Antonio, I wanted to get a sense of what's going on the ground, and I mentioned how many more protests there are and, you know, the fact that, again, people looking for food, for supplies, there are rolling blackouts, the internet, a lot of people don't even have internet anymore in a lot of cases. But how is that affecting people? I mean, at some point, that's got to break people.
It's been taking place. We've seen a lot of looting in different rural areas. There was a big situation in Cumaná, which is in the eastern side of the country, more than a week ago, where there was a lot of looting taking place. The thing is that most of the people are so busy getting in line, trying to get inside of the supermarkets, that they're not getting organized to protest. As you know, there was a big push back in 2014, led by now jailed opposition leader Leopoldo López, to try to get people to massively but pacifically protest against the government. And you had some sort of student uprising, which the government was able to put down. So people remember that, and they're not so, even though they're upset, even though they're desperate, they're not so inclined to go protest anymore.
I'm wondering what's happened since the last parliamentary elections. There was supposedly a shift in power, but what's changed? Antonio, let me start with you.
Well, basically, the government, right before the new assembly took power, they replaced key members of the Supreme Court with people very aligned with them, and even though the assembly legally has the power to make some changes in the country, whenever they take in some key measures, you have the Supreme Court, which is controlled by the executive power, overrule. So in a sense, they have been stripping away the powers of the National Assembly, and they're become a forum where there can be discussions, but no real political measures can be taken.
All right. I want to go to the phones because I put the call out for anyone from Venezuela. If you've just come here recently, or again, if you have family there, I want to get a sense of what's really going on the ground there. Let's go to the phones. I'm going to start with Alfredo in Miami. Alfredo, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm calling because my wife and I, we had to move from Venezuela.
Was it recent?
Yeah, it was only 2 years ago. It was because of security issue. We got kidnapped and it was horrible. But, you know, we had the opportunity to come to the U.S. as young professionals. So we actually fled the country, and we're doing quite well here in the U.S., you know, working on stable jobs and making a career out of our professions. So the thing is that now things are getting so worse in Venezuela that we're being having to send boxes of food to our families and boxes of medicines.
What do you, Alfredo, what do you think is going to happen? This can't continue forever.
I mean, I really don't know. Right now we don't have that much hope, because the military control seems to be so heavy that there's not a clear solution, and the opposition is having a lot of mistakes through the way, and it's really not working out, and it seems that the short term solution is not being put on the word yet. You know, we really don't know what's happening, and we really don't know what's going to be of our country in the next few years.
Well, I and a lot of people feel that way, Alfredo. And the only thing that I can, you know, looking at Venezuela at this moment, I can only say that I don't think you're going to see an immediate, you know, overthrow.
We actually think that if there is a change on power, the economic structure still is going to be too weak. It's going to be a couple of years, or maybe, you know, 5-10 years for it to recover completely.
Here's the most likely scenario. The National Assembly that you were just talking about, they're pushing for a recall referendum, a constitutional recall referendum that would oust Maduro from power. The socialists obviously don't want that to happen, because what would happen after that is a new presidential election, which would most likely elect someone from the opposition as president. So what they want is to hold off, delay this recall referendum until next year, when there would not then be a new presidential election afterward. The vice president would simply replace the ousted president. And then the Chavistas, the socialists, could continue in power until 2019.
All right. Alfredo, do me a favor. I want to put you on hold here. I'd like to just gather some information from you, contact information if possible. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us. I want to turn over now to Jane in Pembroke Pines. Jane, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Yay. Go ahead.
I happen to be an Irish citizen living in Pembroke Pines, but I spent most of my life in Venezuela, 37 years.
Wow.
I have two daughters and four grandchildren there. And what used to be a paradise, it's sad to see that my daughter said to me on the phone today, "Mom, did you remember to send me off for the mosquito bites?"
Well, so
you
just
can't even buy something like that in Venezuela at the moment.
Yeah. So how are they getting by? I mean, we hear these stories of protests and people in lines for food. And I mean, I just mentioned the people who are having to cross the border to get basic supplies.
Yes, I saw that. Can you just hold a second? I'm going to give it to somebody who is much more knowledgeable on that than I am.
Okay.
Hold on.
Live radio, you got to love it. So who am I talking to now?
You're talking to another Venezuelan.
Okay. What's your name?
Rosemary Aguila.
Rosemary, so you're from Venezuela.
Yes, I am.
When's the last time you were there?
About 8 years ago, but I have a lot of relatives there.
So tell me about what you hear from your relatives as to what's going on there right now. What's life like for them?
It's very, very bad. There's no food. There are no medicines. The last week, Mr. Maduro practically turned it into a military dictatorship, because he passed everything to the defense minister, and everything has to go through him. Now,
is there an effort by your family to get out?
My family, most of them, thank God, are out. I still have two brothers and a lot of nieces and nephews.
All right. Well, you know what, Rosemary, thank you so much for sharing. I hope that your family is doing all right, if they're able to get out. But if anything, I hope that they are doing okay. And, you know, thank you again for sharing that information with us. And it's obviously a story that we'll continue to cover. Thank you so much, both of you.
You're welcome.
I want to go to one other person. Jorge, living here in Miami. Jorge, welcome to the program. Jorge, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. I can barely hear you, though.
Yeah, let me step outside.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, my comment is more about the intervention of Cuban politics into Venezuela. And really, in my opinion, the thing of most people, they have some kind of connection with Venezuela, and they try to keep abreast of what's happening there. Really, the big difference between what has happened in Argentina and Brazil, we have seen a turn of the fortunes into a change of government, the right, and Venezuela. It's really the constant intervention of Cuban military personnel in Venezuela in their military. So there is no way whatsoever that anybody in the military in Venezuela can try to do a coup attempt or try to reverse the situation.
Jorge, I'm going to stop you there for 1 second. I apologize because I'm getting a sound through the phone. I don't know if it's the connection, but I did get most of what you said. I appreciate the call. I did actually want to get to that, Tim, is, I mean, look, Venezuela and Cuba had a longstanding relationship for many, many years, but how has that changed? I mean, do you have a comment to what Jorge...
Well, I would actually defer to Antonio on this because Antonio does a remarkable job of covering those, you know, military and security forces issues. I mean, Antonio, do you really think that, the Cuban, you know, presence there really has the influence that it did, you know, a few years ago?
I think they provide the government with a lot of intelligence work. They have eyes within the military. They'd be the first one to tell Maduro something's going on if there was some kind of coup attempt. And they have in the past. There have been some rumblings within the military, and that's from time to time you would see, you know, generals or colonels arrested.
But Antonio, what's changed in their relationship between Cuba and Venezuela since the U.S. and Cuba started talking and opening things up?
I don't think much, even though there's some theories going on about the possibility that Venezuela have been somehow included in the negotiations between the U.S. and Cuba. And it is possible. Maduro hears, I don't want to say that he's controlled, but the Cubans do have a lot of influence upon his decision-making process. And there are some key Chavista government officials that also are very close to Fidel Castro. Not to Fidel, but to the Castro regime in Cuba.
Yeah, let me ask you both this as we finish up. I'm just looking at the time. Is, you know, I mentioned tipping point, and you just, again, you look at any country where any power was overthrown, and there's always seems to be a tipping point. And but, Tim, you just said a moment ago, you don't think there's going to be any kind of overthrow, but is there a tipping point? How much more protest can you have? How much more exodus can you have before people say, enough?
You're going to have to see a lot more of that political base of the Socialist Party in Venezuela become fed up and angry enough to get out into the streets and as you say, overthrow the government. Right now, what you're seeing is the United States actually playing the good cop in this and doing behind-the-scenes negotiations to try to figure out how... Look, the socialist government has no future in Venezuela. What they're trying to do now is negotiate its exit. And it's probably going to take a lot longer than I think, you know, most Venezuelans realize.
And Antonio, real quickly, I give you the final word on that.
I agree with what Tim said. He described that beautifully. There might be a process, and like he said in the beginning, they're going to do all they can to avoid the referendum this year, but there might be some kind of exit strategy for next year.
Antonio Maria Delgado is of El Nuevo Herald. He's joining us from the studios at the Miami Herald. And Tim Padgett for WLRN, our Latin American reporter. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, the Bahamian government has warned its citizens about traveling to the U.S. U.S. officials shortly after warned Americans about going to the Bahamas. All right. So we're going to get to the bottom of all this. It's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Okay, so a week ago, the Bahamian government issued a travel advisory to its citizens traveling here to the U.S. They called on their citizens to avoid protests and crowds, and they urged young men in particular, be cautious when interacting with law enforcement. The advisory came after the police shootings that occurred in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and St. Paul, Minnesota. Not long after that advisory, the U.S. Embassy in Nassau sent out its own security message to U.S. citizens in the Bahamas, and they said, warning them, be mindful of your surroundings at all times and employ practical personal security due to crime. Fred Mitchell, Bahamas Minister of Foreign Affairs and Immigration, had something to say about that warning.
There is no conspiracy theory in this. The timing, I'm certain, is just coincidental. I don't think it has anything to do with it at all.
All right. Are you Bahamian? Because I'm curious. What do you think about the travel advisory? Do you think it's warranted? How do you feel about law enforcement here compared to in your country? Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. All right, Tim Padgett, our Latin American reporter, is still here with us in the studio. I'm also joined by Carolyn Gunnis of the Miami Times. Carolyn, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, Tim, real quickly. So we had these officer-involved shootings. Why did the Bahamian government give out an advisory saying, be careful going to the U.S.?
Well, two basic reasons. More than 90% of the population of the Bahamas is black. And many Bahamians travel back and forth, you know, between the islands and here. And so you've got all that interaction. And I think, my first reaction was, frankly, who is the Bahamian government to be warning people about police violence against blacks? Because the Bahamian police have for years been slammed by Amnesty International and other human rights groups for its own abusive treatment of people in the Bahamas. I mean, it's got a big problem with that. But then again, there is a legitimate concern on the part of a government like Nassau that you've got so many black people from the Bahamas going to the United States in a situation like we've got right now. And I guess it doesn't surprise me all that much, really, that they would issue an advisory like that.
Carolyn, I'm curious if you've seen reports of Bahamian citizens experiencing any kind of harassment from law enforcement here in the United States. I was looking for that.
I haven't heard anything about this, and I called the Bahamian Travel Bureau and asked if they had heard anything, and they said they hadn't heard anything. I tried the consulate, but I didn't get a chance to reach anybody. But I can understand why they would have a concern. I mean, 90% of, like Tim said, the residents are black, and you know, you're not going to know really who is who, because in South Florida, you know, we're so used to accents. So, you know, a police is not going to think that this is a tourist we're dealing with. You know, they're just, if they're doing preventative policing, they're just going to approach them. So I could see a concern.
What have you heard, though, from anyone from the Bahamas or from the, you know, the Bahamian government about this advisory? Are they taking it seriously?
Well, here's the thing, and I've been checking the internet, and what I'm seeing are mixed reviews. Some of the residents feel like, you know, don't prod the sleeping dog, you know, the bad dog. If you antagonize the U.S., then, you know, problems will come your way, as did what happened. The U.S.
Because the advisory said, don't go into crowds, watch out for crowds, don't get involved in, you know, protests. But it also was talking about, especially with young men, if you deal with the police, be respectful and quiet. I wonder too, Tim, because you talk about, you had pointed out too in your commentary, not just from the Bahamas, from Latin America, you have a lot of people who come from countries, they don't trust the police at all. So when they deal with cops here, you know, I think they have a very different attitude about how they're going to deal with cops.
Sure. I mean, you're talking about an entire continent, Latin America and the Caribbean, where people really tend to distrust cops as much as they do the criminals, as much as they fear the criminals. So, they do bring a different mindset, you know, to that situation here. But I think the subtext of the Bahamian advisory, I think, is really more interesting. You've got, as I said, Latin America and the Caribbean. That's a region that's where cops are infamous for beating up the underdog, particularly minorities and poor people. And I really think that that Bahamian advisory, what we should take it for is as a warning to U.S. police that you're looking a little bit too much like Latin American and Caribbean cops these days, and you don't want to go down that path.
And you've already had a few people comment to you about that up to this point. I want to go to the phones because, I posted out this question. If you're from the Bahamas, I want to know how you feel about this travel advisory and how much time you spend in the United States. Let's start with Denise, I believe it is, in Fort Lauderdale.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, Denise.
I was born in the Bahamas, and I grew up in Florida, so I've been here all my life pretty much. I have family who all live in the Bahamas on my mother's side. And yes, crime has risen over there, but compared to what's going on over here now, I know that advisory that U.S. has given is not coincidental at all. That was on purpose. purpose.
So how do you feel about this travel advisory, though, to Bahamians coming here? And again, all of this comes after the police officer-involved shootings and then, of course, the massacre in Dallas. But, I mean, you know, how are Bahamians treating that advisory, and are they concerned about police officers here?
I think it's valid, and they should be. I totally support that warning that they gave to their citizens, and I think it's the right thing to do. I mean, even the people here in the United States, we need to be mindful of these situations. It's a shame that we have to do this now, but this is what it is.
All right, Denise, thank you so much.
The Bahamians come over a lot anyway, so they're here almost daily. So
all right,
trying to give a different perspective.
Denise, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. I want to move over to Sam in Kendall. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sam, you said you've lived in the Bahamas.
Yeah, I lived there a number of years ago, but I was raised in South Florida since the mid-50s, and I will tell you that I'm very thankful. I spent a number of years, pleasant years, in the Bahamas. My oldest child, my daughter, was born there.
But do you have...
It's not a perfect society, but I will tell you, if you look at the history books, Bahamians were part of setting up the city of Miami. And if you look at how they've been treated through the decades and the past century, the warning is not, it's not ill-founded. It simply put, America is racist, and it doesn't know if it doesn't realize it, even if it bites someone in the behind. America is so racist, I can understand the Bahamian government, to some extent, warning people. If black American parents have to teach their children how to behave with police, why shouldn't the Bahamian government be responsible to duly or appropriately warn its predominant black culture to also be careful when they come to the United States and are in the presence of police?
Sam, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate the comment. Tim?
No.
Carolyn, I'm sorry. Carolyn, your take on, you've heard two people from the Bahamas or have been in the Bahamas. What is your take on what they've mentioned about that, and especially what just Sam just said about, you know, the attitude that they should have or have towards not just this country, but the police here?
Well, the police here do what they call preventative policing. So they are always looking for some sort of crime. They anticipate a crime, I believe. And so...
But at the same time, you know, the big controversy right now is obviously white officers, are they racist towards black people?
And I feel like they are. I feel like they come with a bias. I think they come with already expecting that this person is probably going to be on the wrong side of the law. And that poses a problem when they have to deal with people who they consider suspects.
Just real quickly, too, by the way, because we heard from one of the callers, a lot of people from the Bahamas come to the United States. They come to South Florida to do business regularly. Do you think this travel advisory hurts business here? Because maybe a lot of people will say, I'm not going to South Florida now.
Well, I think that they want to say that, but they can't because of this symbiotic relationship that they've developed with the U.S. They come over here for shopping. A lot of their kids are educated here. And that's one of the things that they worried about a little bit with, you know, having their children here. And it's like, you know, are now they exposed? Are they going to be, you know, harassed? And so some people applaud the government for stepping up and saying, hey, you know, be careful. The United States is not as safe as it should be.
And if you are from the Bahamas, please share that thought. Please share your thoughts. Tell us what you think about everything that you've heard and seen. And if you feel safe in this country, find us on Facebook, facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Carolyn Gunness is with the Miami Times. We also heard from Tim Padgett here at WLRN. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to finish up real quickly. Do you remember when the state's tourism agency, Visit Florida, hired rapper Armando Christian Perez? Oh, come on, Pitbull. You know who I'm talking about. I wanna go somewhere exotic. All right, so he's come out with this song promoting Florida. It's called Sexy Beaches. He's being paid by you, the taxpayer, for this song to promote Florida. I've got one problem with it, just one. It seems like they filmed it in Florida, in Miami. If you're promoting the host state, have you ever been to Jacksonville Beach or Daytona Beach or Pensacola Beach or Fort Myers Beach? They all look kind of different. But that and the fact that we're paying this guy to do this. This song, Sexy Beaches. Have you heard it? Tell me what you think. But either way, that's the end of the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Have a wonderful weekend.